Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Welcome to the fourth episode of our Strategy and Insider podcast, where we aim to explore some of the most critical future trends and their impacts. In each episode, we discuss the most fundamental questions in the healthcare industry with health experts from different sectors. And my name is Thomas Obach. I'm a partner at Strategy End, and I'm the host of our first podcast season. In our last episode, I really had the pleasure to discuss how technology will change the way patients, for instance, access medicine in the future, together with Teresa Graham, who is the head of global product strategy at Roche Pharma. And I am still very much impressed by both her insights, but also her open perspectives that she shared, particularly around her perspective on the interplay between the traditional side of healthcare and the tech side entering the healthcare space. And after having welcomed a bioinformatician and a physician, as well as a global pharma executive in our first three episodes, we're now going to cover a new industry perspective. And I'm very honored and thrilled to welcome my guest today, who is a serial health entrepreneur with more than 30 years of clinical and academic expertise in the medical device sector. And not only he is a founder and investor, but also a fully educated cardiac surgeon. So welcome, Georg Matthijs.
The honor is mine, and I'm glad to be here.
Georg, you hold various board positions in successful companies that offer highly innovative digital healthcare solutions. And one example being that you recently joined the advisory board of a very promising digital therapy solution that treats respiratory diseases, talking about Vision Health, a startup that recently successfully completed a venture funding round that you have actually been leading. And before this and other responsibilities, you have been joining the board of Xenios AG, which is a leader in technologies and therapies for minimally invasive support of both pulmonary and cardiac functions and diseases. So this brings a well-rounded package of experience to our podcast today. So very much looking forward to having discussions around the future of health with you, Georg. So looking at your CV, I see two distinct lives, if I'm honest. Yeah, first being you as a surgeon that you started off your career at, and second, your life as entrepreneur in the medical field. So probably starting with your first life, what made you decide becoming a surgeon in the very first place? What drove your interest in the human body and doing something to fix certain conditions as a surgeon?
That is a very tricky question indeed, because life's not been a business plan. It is not a business plan.
Yeah.
So it just happened. It wasn't planned that way. It was in part socialization, triggered by mentors, by personal experiences over time. And I'd been, you know, looking for a topic for my PhD thesis, and there was a handwritten note on the university bulletin board. You know, one of those non-digital bulletin boards. It was a piece of paper with a scribbled phone number, not a mobile phone. So I called and met this young surgeon who had posted the note, and we spoke about his scientific work, and he was dealing with organ protection, how to keep organs alive longer without blood supply. And it was fascinating. There was empathy on his behalf. There was energy, and I just loved the environment. And I embarked on this journey by, you know, diving deep into cardiac surgery as a student. I've been in the OR, on the ward, talking to patients in the research lab. It was my life. It took away most of my time as a student. I managed to, you know, finish med school with a great exam, though, and with a thesis. But
real
I
life
decided,
examples then. Huh?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's a good term. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. And so without having planned a surgical career, it just happened. It's that easy, actually.
And that's probably also part of our lives, right? So some things you can plan and some things you discover by accident.
Yes. Huh? And that topic actually has remained the leitmotif for about 30 years now. It's organ protection, how to keep organs alive, how to make organ failure bearable for patients, how to have an unlimited supply for transplantable organs in the end. That's pretty much what's been driving me.
So basically what you're saying is there is, and we come to your second life, surely, there is a red string throughout your life that started somewhat by accident at the very beginning as a young medical student being intrigued by that, what you just outlined, but still you're staying true to that still now in your life and your career from a very different angle. But let me probe onto that because, I mean, being a surgeon and being well-trained and well-researched at the time at a well-renowned university clinic here in Frankfurt, where we're meeting actually today again, what made you switch? Because for most of the people, such a position, such a meaning in life would be kind of the apex of their careers. But you changed into doing something very different in terms of, again, becoming a founder and increasingly now also an investor. What made you change there?
I owe this to my mentors, and I'm grateful for that because both my basic science mentor, mm-hmm. who comes from Big Pharma,
okay,
and my surgical and physiological research mentor, who has been patenting his ideas, working with startups to making them new therapies or new diagnostic tools, have taught me unknowingly, aside from the art of cardiac surgery and the art of doing physiological research in the lab, how to transcend from a medical need into a new therapy. Mm-hmm. And that is something I believe needs to be taught in medical schools. And I'm incredibly grateful when I returned. My first 3 years were at UCLA after graduating from medical school. Yeah. When I returned to Germany, it was a disaster. It was November. It was gray.
Like now.
Right? Like now? It's November again.
And gray as well, unfortunately.
Glad you mentioned it. And ultimately, a good friend of mine who founded a private equity fund in Frankfurt was my local mentor, mm-hmm. who taught me what's different in Europe as opposed to the US, who took me along to due diligence work, etc. So I was prepared for what would happen 5 years later, founding my first own medical device company. So wow. I'm grateful yeah. to all those mentors.
Yeah, so... Again, something that you probably cannot plan so much for because you personally need to connect to these people that helped you develop your career very successfully as you did. You touched upon one important point, the difference between the US and Germany and environments being probably different, but also secondly, founding startups. Nowadays, even more importantly, to have a good kind of basis, infrastructure, landscape for startups. How do you see that shaping up in Germany? What's the current status? Are we ahead or are we behind the wave of this compared to others?
Despite a wealth of technology, we're lagging behind and we're falling behind year by year.
Okay.
And I think there's a number of reasons. I'd like to focus on three of them.
Okay.
One being that there is seed funding and the government has not done a bad job. There is the BAFA Invest program, for example. There is the high-tech Gründerfonds and other tools that I think are just well done mm-hmm. and very helpful. But after that seed stage, there is a great difficulty to achieve a substantial Series A, 8-digit euro amount funding to really get a meaningful innovation going. Mm-hmm. And that is where some founders already give up mm-hmm. and where I think the largest gap on the funding side is. And there's also a cultural problem in that there is a naive belief, and that's not typically German, it's Mitteleuropa. Mm-hmm. Whether you go to the Czech Republic or to Northern Italy, it's the same mentality. Terrific engineers, mm-hmm. bright technology people, but the complete, utter lack of understanding that it takes more money to establish a new therapy with clinical data, mm-hmm. reimbursement, coding, regulatory approval, just to mention a few, yeah. and not even mentioning clinical marketing. Yeah. That is the problem why there is no awareness for the funding needs of innovative, not just medical device, but healthcare companies in general.
And that, I think personally, there is a big difference between health-related developments and startups versus in other places where we don't have that strict regulation when it comes to proving medical efficacy, effectiveness, safety, and actually benefits for the patient. And then translating that into pricing and reimbursement evidence that someone like a payer or someone like a regulator would buy into and believe into, there is a big difference to others.
Yes.
And thanks very much for laying out that. And let me probe one aspect on the cultural element, because I sometimes have the impression if you fail in the US, you failed for good and you learned a lot. Yeah? And the more you fail, the more you learn, the more you prepared for the next big step where then it will eventually work out. If you fail here in the Western European, German world, is there any difference? And how did you experience that? Because I can imagine as you successfully funded some companies, you must have been making mistakes yourself in younger years, I can imagine. Can you elaborate on that a little?
We all have our long lists of mistakes that we learned from. And in my first startup, I made such a mistake in that the founders team wasn't strong enough to bring this forward. And upon recognizing this, I was looking for an early exit. Uh-huh. But that wasn't rewarding enough for my co-founders. So I ended up selling my shares 3 years down the road mm-hmm. with a lot of pain and actually joined a spin-off of a buyer, of a potential buyer for that startup.
Okay.
Which was a good decision.
Yeah.
But lesson learned, never go for second class. Always go with top people on the team. And also seek failure early. Be the devil's advocate for your own business plan day by day. And love the investors who don't fund you as long as they give you good feedback on where your gaps and shortcomings are.
So stay open to feedback that you can build up on and learn from, yeah, and, mm-hmm. and honor that openness if someone yes. gives that to you and appreciate it.
Yeah. Great. And don't let your excitement take you away from reality.
Yeah, and don't love your solution then too much that you don't accept any feedback from others mm-hmm. that have a more objective perspective on
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So Georg, since you have been an innovator and founder and medic since 30 plus years now, yeah, you did innovate in the past and you're still innovating now. If you compare the past and the now, what's now possible that wasn't possible, let's say 10 years ago? What changed there?
That question takes us to a fascinating age, because looking at the early 1990s up until today, we saw a tremendous decline in invasiveness of many therapies. Mm-hmm. Let me give you two examples okay. from cardiac medicine. In the 1990s, it was most prevalent, or let's say the 80s and 90s, it was most prevalent to treat advanced coronary artery three-vessel disease with bypass grafts. You would take a vein from the patient's leg or another blood vessel from the patient's chest and use it as a bypass to bring blood behind a stenosis, a narrowing of a coronary blood vessel. That is major surgery with a heart-lung machine and with its own set of complications. And its mm-hmm. long-term benefits are, of course, unrivaled. But then suddenly there was a balloon that was inserted with a catheter without surgery. And then this balloon would expand a stent, which is a wire cage in the vessel, to dilate it and open it up again.
Yeah.
And suddenly clinicians confronted patients with a very provocative questions. And I quote a colleague of mine who said, "Do you want to be split like a chicken and be operated on a heart-lung machine? Or do you want to have a catheter in your vessel that opens it up and gives blood flow back, and tomorrow you can have dinner with your wife by the beach?"
Wow.
I know it's very provocative, but this is the mega trend from surgery to catheter intervention that has first changed the treatment of coronary artery disease. And then in a second wave in this century, we've seen the change in the treatment of valve disease, where traditionally a valve is being replaced with the heart-lung machine and a long recovery period. And today, in a large subset of patients, a catheter with a folded valve can be advanced into the patient's heart and unfolded there, and pressing the old damaged valve to the wall and unfolding a new valve. And that is an interventional procedure that doesn't take a long hospital stay and doesn't take the clinician to open the chest or anything like that. So the mega trend is from surgery to intervention, and that has also trickled down to other areas. Look at neurology. In neurology, stroke was a fatal thing.
Yeah.
It was treated with rehab. And
yeah,
then
pretty much, yeah.
It became a medical emergency. And you saw all those campaigns that were wonderful. Stroke units were designed, and the time window of 1 hour from event to treatment was increasingly considered. And suddenly we see that the treatment of stroke has gone over 2-3 decades from contemplation to intervention. And that's fantastic. And I think we're going beyond this because it will have structural impact. The structural impact on healthcare is that if we go from surgery to intervention and from hospital stay to outpatient treatments, we are going to need fewer hospital beds and fewer hospitals. And sure. Our access to those fewer hospitals that by being larger and centralized will provide better quality. I mean, that's not up for discussion. I don't want to discuss this anymore. That's solid data. And every small town politician wants their hospital back, wants to hold on to their hospital. And they're not aware how much damage to quality of care they're doing to their population. I know this is very edgy, but it's a statement based on data. And I think we will see that trend going further with a more ambulatory and less invasive medicine.
Now probably switching into, and this is where we had also prior to today, a lot of discussion around the future of healthcare and where we're heading as a society. And you know the study that we have been writing up on, that we believe that the future of healthcare will be very much people-driven, where we are the center around the both health and the lifestyle data that we are accommodating and accumulating around. Second, it will be preventative in addition to caring and curing at some place. It will be personalized, as we experience that already today in care and medications, but even more so in prevention. It will and must be digitally enabled because, I mean, we're both medics, right? We can't keep up with all the knowledge that is incorporated and developed. There needs to be a digital mean and a digital support of doctors making proper decisions, incorporating all the knowledge that is out there. And lastly, it will be integrated into our lives very much more as in the past. And with that said, what is your vision of that health? Do you see those trends? Do you think they will become a reality? What's your general perception of it?
First of all, thanks for introducing the environment we're in now and the environment that shapes our current and future healthcare environment. Let me go back into history for a second. Up until the 19th century, there wasn't much a physician could do to influence the course of the patient's disease. Mm-hmm. With a lot of empathy, physicians accompanied patients until death. And they accompanied them with a age-old, millennia-old ways of dealing between patients and physicians that come back from the Eastern Mediterranean and have become somewhat neglected or even lost in the course of the first successes. We can now mitigate or even cure some diseases. Mm-hmm. So we've become, as a medical in society, more powerful in treating disease. We're not anywhere near. We're still in the Middle Ages when it comes to certain disease states, but we've advanced. But we've lost the empathy, the patient-physician relationship.
The time with the patient.
The time with the patient, exactly. Yeah. And that can be regained. And I think that is one of the greatest opportunities in digital health and AI. We can regain, reclaim, or basically enable a renaissance of the patient-physician relationship that has largely been hijacked by paramedicine in some countries by freeing time that now is a terrible administrative burden on caregivers in healthcare towards the physician-patient relationship. And if we do that and have the screening and diagnostic process assisted by AI, I think we can move not just on the technical or therapeutic side, we can also advance culturally and on the human side in healthcare.
Now that's very interesting, that regaining of proper dialogues between a patient and a doctor will be very important and does have a lot of impact on a patient's life, who heard probably about one of the most devastating messages or diseases that he can or she can ever hear about. So that is really interesting, that element around regaining time for your conversation between the doctor and the patient, and the doctor rather becoming kind of a health coach to the patient, him or herself. However, given this is more a topic, and again, in our more Western world, where we do have sufficient enough doctors to treat patients, there is other places in our world where you don't have those physicians in large numbers. How do you see it there? What's your perspective in the more developing and low to middle income markets of the world?
I'm glad you raised the issue of developing countries in the upcoming digital healthcare market, because we're living in luxury and we're discussing topics such as patient-physician relationship with time to talk, with physicians' empathy undergoing a renaissance. That's wonderful, and I'm not criticizing it. But on the other hand, digital healthcare and just using smartphones or Apple Watches or whatever devices you need to provide the very basic healthcare to those people, to those billions who do not have access to a physician within, say, 100 kilometers or 200 kilometers of outreach. That is tremendous in that there is potential with very little investment to reach many patients and to get at least a very basic level of healthcare to them. And there's a few people who are embarking on this journey, and I think investing in this part of digital health is fantastic. And perhaps we will have repercussions on our luxurious Western world healthcare system in learning from these approaches.
Yeah. Me personally, I think this is where we also will see the leapfrog happen in terms of how we innovate going forward, because they don't have a system to take along. They just don't have a system to cope with, yeah? And they need to find solutions for their patients in very need and suffering from malaria or other infectious diseases. So, thanks a lot for sharing that side of healthcare as well. That is as important as what we have discussed beforehand. And towards that digitally enabled world where you have a physician being supported by readouts and analysis of big data, we have also seen in the study that most of the people do believe this will be triggered and fostered by big tech companies and smaller tech companies. Is that something that you would also see, that they are basically taking somewhat of a dominating catalyst role in future to make that happen? Or do you have a very different perspective on that?
No, I share that. I share that full-heartedly. And I just don't know as to how much the Alphabets and Apples will own a large part of healthcare, mm-hmm. and how much traditional healthcare players will digitalize themselves to an extent that they can survive and thrive in the digital healthcare sector. And not knowing where exactly this is going to end up, I think there is great opportunity for the, and I think we talked about that briefly before, for some traditional players who have achieved something that I believe will be precious for the decades to come. They've achieved vertical integration. They Yeah. offer product, devices, drugs, the service by employing doctors, nurses, etc., by owning the hospitals or the outpatient clinics. So they own the therapy.
Yeah.
And these entities have, even without having a perfect digital record of all they do, but still looking at the overall amount of data they've amassed, they have the power to improve healthcare in their sector and dramatically advance. And I think it's time to look at such vertical integrated companies a little more closely.
So another recent news that was announced by Amazon is that they are further expanding its activities in the healthcare sector, yeah, by taking over the startup called Health Navigator. And they actually are becoming part of the recently launched subsidiary of Amazon called Amazon Care for their employees. And this actually offers for the employees novel telemedicine solutions, online chats with nurses, delivery systems for medication, and even app-enabled, as they call it, house calls or even to an employee's office or home. Bottom line, this innovation is showcasing that they are virtually disintermediating and crossing over industry boundaries. And also Teresa from Roche from last time, she was actually saying at that intersection of the tech industry and the traditional pharma and medtech industry, this is where the magic will happen at that intersection, who brings that together. What's your perspective on that? Do you believe into that, that this is where the magic will happen? And who do you think needs to come together for such a fruitful cooperation here?
I completely share the statement that Teresa made. I think it's a very promising approach to look at this intersection. And this intersection is also something I've experienced in one of my startups. The intersection and the integration between, say, players who are coming from digital, who have, you know, taken a new infrastructural and procedural look at how healthcare works, such as Amazon, a very commendable project, by the way, together with drug makers, medical device companies, biotech companies, and researchers. Once they cross boundaries, once they collaborate, we will see new types of companies that are not limited to providing services, to running hospitals, to making drugs, devices, or biotech solutions. I think we can move towards integrated companies that, for example, care for a certain organ block, like the heart and the lung. Mm-hmm. For example, look at the logo of United Therapeutics. It's the heart and the lung as an organ block and the interaction between those organs. They have an organ focus. And having an organ focus, rather than being a drug maker or a device maker, will address the issues we're also having on the regulatory side. I was completely frustrated when the regulators told us, that was more than a decade ago, that a drug / biotech coding on a device would fall into the abyss. There is no regulation for that. And one notified body said this, the other said that, and they were all disagreeing. And in the end, it was difficult. And ultimately, there was no investment made, no further investment in this anti-biofilm coding. So the regulators stopped this integration.
Yeah.
At these crossroads where sectors and the old and the new industries meet, that is where innovation happens. And regulators, I think, should, and I hope they will be intelligent enough to do that, should open borders for cross-sector collaboration, for more integrated looks at healthcare. I think that's where the benefit will be.
So let me probe a little more, because you're also one of those startups, tech entrepreneurs, as we reference them, being a catalyst towards that new future that bears a lot of benefits to society and people. One of your companies actually uses artificial intelligence in the area of respiratory diseases, and to make their lives better and improve the effectiveness of inhalation therapies. Can you explain a little more what you're doing there, what the big promise is behind that, your big belief, why you are so active in this, but also where you see the hurdles to come?
Mm-hmm. Admittedly, this is the startup you mentioned, Vision Health, has been my first digital health engagement, and I was thrilled to meet the founders and learn about the gaps in inhalation therapy that I heard about theoretically, in that in a, say, regulatory approval trial, there is great attention to teaching patients how to inhale properly and to get the drug into their lungs to the right spot where it's supposed to act. However, in day-to-day practice, this is not done to the extent that we know from the approval trials. So part of the dose does not arrive where it's supposed to arrive, which results in more hospitalizations, potentially reduced quality of life. And that's a major issue because Europe and US alone, there's about 200 million asthma patients alone who are largely treated with drugs and inhalers being a large part of that. So we decided to embark on the journey to have an AI app that teaches and coaches patients to improve their inhalation therapy, to get as much of the drug that they inhale to the parts of the lung where it's supposed to act.
So basically, can I imagine then someone is using that inhaler and that inhaler is somehow connected to your startup, and they read out the usage of the inhaler of that very patient and compare that to others and gives advice to that very patient on how to use it better and more effectively? Is it that what I can kind of visualize?
That's pretty much on the spot. And it allows also to highlight two ways these apps could go. One way is to completely work without sensors, without hardware, that is.
Okay.
On the other hand, there's players who combine sensors that feed data into, say, a smartphone to enhance that loop between a therapy and the digital device that helps improve the therapy.
And how do the physicians react to that? Isn't that something that the physicians are willing to kind of co-prescribe to their patients, or is there hesitance from doctors? Where do you see that? And probably it's a combination of the two, I guess.
Let's split this answer and go to the prescription topic as a second answer. Mm-hmm. The first answer is the acceptance both on behalf of physicians, nurses, and patients is positive because they see that it's a simple, easy to use tool to improve their inhalation therapy. That is the easy part. The more difficult part, both on the acceptance side and also on the rollout side, because that's very sketchy and there's not much going on. Last week, Bundestag decided on the prescription of therapy apps, for example. And that is a novelty that is unusually bold for German healthcare, that on the other hand limits access to data for research purposes, for example. That is contradictory, and I haven't made up my mind on this contradiction. And there are many of those contradictions around. But in any case, I think this is a bold move. And even if some voices say it's too early, the threshold is too low, this may at least start a learning process where we can differentiate between apps that make a contribution to improved quality of life, for example, and others that remain gadgets. But that process is best not in the hands of the regulators, but in the hands of the healthcare community that will ultimately decide what works and what doesn't. So I think it's a good move, and I welcome this.
I think there is a lot of positives to fostering the EHR system in Germany and make that something real by 2021, A, and B, also giving inroads for novel applications, as you have been talking about in the field of asthma, for instance, where you are gaining access to funding as a statutory health insured person, that after showing an initial safety, functionality, and data privacy and protection, that you can get access to that and have that for 12 months, but give that startup that innovates it a 12-month period of time to show benefit to patients. I think this is a good step forward in order to foster innovation. I'm absolutely with you. Let me probe on the other bit that you're referencing, which is a centralized database where data is captured coming from payer claims data from, again, statutory health insurances, which is something in the range of 73 million lives in Germany, and integrates that data in a pseudonymized way and gives access to researchers in an anonymized way based upon their request, but it does exclude others than researchers. What is your perspective on that? Because I can see that the positive here and the negative there that you have been referencing. What's your perspective?
Yes, that question takes us back to the cultural gap between Europe and the US and other parts of the world. In that there is, for example, in the US, there's sanctions, there's tough sanctions. I think $10,000 per individual patient data set that you have to pay as a penalty if you do not comply with data protection.
Wow.
$10,000 per patient data set.
Yeah.
And that's massive. And in Europe, of course, it's more fear-driven. And ultimately, I think the dark side view of the industry and the bright side view of the public sector, which is traditionally Europe, is in the way of therapy improvement for patients. Of course, there needs to be strong data protection. This is very, very critical. But if we sacrifice the benefits for our longevity, for our quality of life, by ignoring this wealth of data that can help improve healthcare, I think we're making a big mistake. And bringing those two worlds together, the legislators, industry, and patient advocates, I think, that are not really visible in the system, would be timely. Because the dangers I see is that this is going to happen elsewhere, and it is happening elsewhere, and we're going to be left out and going to be left out like we've been left out in pharmaceutical innovation. It's virtually gone from Germany. We've been the world's pharmacy. Why are we not the world's pharmacy anymore? And why are we on the way to, you know, losing our strong position in medical devices, its regulation?
Yeah, and I very much like your comment around the fear-driven approach to it that we're having in Europe. Hearing the sanction part of the US solution at the one side, but also the other side, hot off the press now, beginning of November 19, from Google having access via Ascension, which is one of the biggest non-for-profit health systems in the US, having access to EHR data and running artificial intelligence and machine learning aspects on these data sets. I mean, they do have already now, through that project that they call Nightingale, they have access to millions of lives in the US, across more than 20 states in the US. So it's massive data. They're fostering through that innovation. At the same time, people are obviously, and probably also rightly, questioning the data privacy of it. But at the same time, they give sanctions out for each data set that is going to leak, which is massive, listening to the 10,000K each. So that's basically, on the one hand, fostering innovation and pushing. On the other hand, sanctioning someone who is not using it properly. Where do you see that? Because would you be of the belief that we need to give also access to researching companies to that data set, in addition to researchers, academic researchers, given that they have tons of experience in scaling these type of innovations and bringing that into real life of clinicians using it, rather than having a research project done on a certain aspect? Where do you see that? And what's the need there?
There is a great need and there's great potential, but I would suggest that if industry gains access to this kind of massive databases, that it should be done in collaboration with at least some academic researchers that also have a certain watchdog function in the project. But generally speaking, I think the accessibility should be there. And I also believe that once such projects have yielded results that benefit certain patient groups with certain diseases, we're going to see more positive attitudes in the population for this type of projects. Right now, it's not really visible for the general population what benefits can be achieved with this type of big healthcare data.
So thanks, Georg, up until here. I think we had a thrilling, very insightful discussion already. Let's try to sum it up, what the major points were for both you and myself during today's discussion, and do that really in the dialogue. So first, what has been your key takeaway for today and going forward?
My key takeaway for today, and also for my last couple of years as an apprentice in digital health, is that we are approaching an age with fundamental changes in the healthcare system, in the healthcare structure, driven by the digital world. And we're seeing initial attempts to liberate that digital healthcare animal, like the German legislation that passed Bundestag last week that allows therapy apps to be prescribed by physicians. And that is just opening doors, and I think opening doors on the borders between the various healthcare sectors, between drugs, devices, apps, digital data, and that is where the music will be. So I'm very supportive of that legislation, and I think without, you know, expecting anything, we should just watch, analyze, and then readjust over time. But I think this is the way to go ahead with digital healthcare, to open doors to learning and advancing this new sector.
Now, it's certainly absolutely promising that we're seeing these markets open up and the willingness to foster innovation and refund innovation, as we have seen that now beginning of November 2019 in Germany. So to me, on that point of what are the key takeaways for me personally, one, very pragmatically and simplistically, learning from you as a serial entrepreneur, bottom line, you cannot plan everything and you need to remain open to change and career changes and innovation to happen. Second is that the biggest belief or the biggest opportunity emerging from digital health is also to be seen in basically gaining time between a physician and a patient and being a health coach and a life coach to a patient again, because you're gaining time through not being bogged down by too many of your codings and documentation and integration of various data sets in the first place. And lastly, I think this intersection play that we earlier referenced with a convergence of interest will be a big lever to make that digital and data-driven future of health a reality. So with that said, Georg, again, thanks a lot for your time. It was really thrilling to have you here and I very much honored the time that we had. For more information, everyone listening here to us during the podcast, please do visit our strategy and website and do download our latest thinking, Future of Health study. And you also have access to the latest podcast that we did produce beforehand. So stay tuned and bear with us. Thank you.
Strategy and Strategy made real.